to GalacticConnection.com, one of the most popular blogs on the World Wide Web today for alternative news. Stay tuned for the latest information on our world shift from enslavement to galactic involvement, as well as current intel on any blockages impeding us from our sovereign birthright. Knowledge and self-mastery are key at this time. Our commitment is to present you with the latest breaking conspiratorial articles, off-world messages, exopolitics, cutting-edge technologies and sciences, and also an ever-significant intertwining of spiritual support and metaphysical scope that one needs to dive down the rabbit hole and search for truth with balance. We are truly on the horizon of a new golden age filled with the promise for more love, worldwide peace, and accelerated intuitive skills, where every living being can exist in cohesion and abundance. It is whatever we envision and dream this new world to be. I say to you now, let's redefine the new world to the beginnings of our own precious heaven on earth. Galactic Connection is here to provide the pulse of Mother Earth through an eclectic range of interviews each Tuesday afternoon from 3 to 4:55 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, Station 2 on BBS Radio, expanding your perspectives on how we can once and for all take back our freedoms, our joy, and our connection with our mighty I Am presence. Our intention remains true to connect hearts and minds everywhere in order to obtain global unity and galactic and universal acceptance. Our discussions will continue to cover anything to do with galactic society and our involvement with our galactic brothers and sisters. Our guests are experts in their fields, and our radio shows have been coined as some of the most thought-provoking out there. In addition to our daily blog, which runs 365 days a year, we also offer a realm of healing services such as our world-renowned implant removal processes, our spiritual past life clearings, our galactic violet ray alchemy from Alexandra, who shares in the lineage of Merlin, and other cutting-edge healing technologies. Check our site out at galacticconnection.com now. Sending you a wave of light, love, and inspiration, and a personal hug and thank you for listening to our Galactic Connection radio show and visiting our blog today. Good afternoon, everyone. This is Alexandra Metters of GalacticConnection.com, and this is a pre-recorded interview for April 12th, 2016. And I have with me today a very special guest. I've had my eye on him for a while. I've been watching all the controversial stuff that kind of floats around him all the time, surfacing that which has been buried within the American history in particular, but all over the world, frankly. And this is Scott Walter. Scott Walter is a world-renowned forensic geologist and specialist in the secret history of North America. He is an author, a researcher, and a television host for the series H2 series called America Unearthed. Scott has also been the founder and president of American Petrographic Services and the inventor of the archaeopetrography, which I'd like to talk about. And I hope I didn't just destroy that word.
Good job.
Scott has also been involved in analyzing the concrete remains of the World Trade Center after the September 11th terrorist attacks, which is what really got my attention. His first television appearance involved the Kensington runestones, which were discovered in Minnesota in 1898 and revealed in the documentary Holy Grail in America, which I can't imagine any of you that have not already seen that. He's the author of many books, one of the latest, which is Compelling New Evidence. So, Scott, welcome today. And I also wanted to get everybody to be aware that he will be at the New Living Expo from April 29th to May 1st at the San Mateo County Event Center in San Mateo, California. So, yeah. Welcome.
Thank you. Well, thanks for having me. I appreciate that. That's lovely introduction. And just so you know, the New Living Expo, I'll be speaking on Saturday. I think that's the 30th, from 11 to 1 o'clock. So I get 2 hours. And that's good because my wife can tell you I love to ramble on because it's really, there's so much good information. It's a complicated story. But as I say, people say the devil's in the detail. I say the truth is in the details. So we're going to get a chance to lay it all out.
Well, do us a favor and explain the petrography that you have created and really made famous.
Archaeopetrography. Well, you know, take a step back. The work that I've been doing when we founded American Petrographic Services, really what it is, it's the microscopic examination in our business of concrete and rock primarily. And what we do is we will get problem concrete that comes in, low strength, cracking, scaling, whatever the case may be, something has gone wrong. And so they'll take a sample, they'll send it to us, and we will examine it and try to determine, first of all, what caused the problem. But the thing they really want to know is, whose fault is it? So we get involved in a lot of litigation, as you can imagine. And the one thing that I tell people is, you know, look, the concrete didn't crack just to make you mad. It did make you mad, but there's a reason why it happened. So I try to depersonalize the situation by saying, look, let's just stick to the science, let the science talk, and whatever the results are. And so we had a successful business. Obviously, you talked about the Pentagon work. That'll probably be the thing that people will talk about the day that they put me in the ground. And it was an amazing thing. It was an honor and a privilege to be involved in that work. Yes. Again, you know, something happened and we were asked to do our work and we did it. So,
and it also caused a lot of controversy to follow you around as well. I mean, it's one of the main reasons that why you experience what you do.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of people that I've been contacted for years by people in the conspiracy community that have a lot of questions about what happened at 9/11.
Sure.
And I can tell you, look, nobody likes a good conspiracy better than me, but you know, you have to have some hard evidence to bring to the discussion. Otherwise, I'm really not interested in talking about what could have been, you know, maybe.
Sure.
I want some hard stuff. And if there is, I'll go there as far as we need to go. In the case of the Pentagon, I can tell you that it was a 757. There were people on that plane, and what happened there is what they said happened there. Now, what happened up at Ground Zero, I don't know. There's a lot of interesting questions that have been asked. I wasn't there, so I can't speak to that, but I can tell you what happened at the Pentagon.
Cool. Well, so how, going back to your archaeopetrography,
right.
You explain to us exactly how do you, you know, date and get information from the rocks and that sort of thing?
Well, basically what we've done is applied the same science that we use on concrete and rock in the construction industry to these archaeological lithic or stone artifacts that have come into our lab over the years. It started with the Kensington Runestone, and what I was asked to do in that investigation was to try to age date the carvings. Was there a way that we would be able to say something about how long ago the inscription was carved? And the fact of the matter is, we had never done any work like that before, but we came up with an idea that we thought would work. And basically what I did was I identified key minerals in the runestone and looked at the weathering of those same minerals on tombstones of known age. And we had all the same criteria in the experiment, the same mineral grain size, the same weathering environment. The tombstones are both above and below grade. The runestone was found basically at grade and then angling down about a foot. So really it worked beautifully as far as having everything replicated, if you will. And so with the dates on the tombstones, I just went back in time until the minerals began to come off the surface of the tombstones. On the runestone, they were already gone. So it worked really well, and I was able to conclude that the weathering of the inscription was older than 200 years, because that's when they began to come off the surface. They're all gone on the runestone. Now, and that's from when it was pulled out of the ground in 1898, because it hasn't been in the weathering environment since. It's been indoors. So in my mind, you know, in our business, everything boils down to logic. If this, then that, and if not this, then this. And it really makes it very easy. And in this case, the question was, it's either a late 19th century hoax or it's not. And if it's not, what have you got? Well, It's dated 1362. The language, the runes, the dialect, everything is consistent with that period. The weathering says it's not a late 19th century hoax, so logic demands it must be genuine. So I wrote a report and published all my findings. They were peer-reviewed, in spite of what a lot of people say. They don't want it to be peer-reviewed because they don't want to believe the results. And
Scott, the other thing that's going on here is there's been a lot of suggestion that not only do we live in this hidden hand of who's really running the show, so to speak, but there's been an incredible amount of work done to hide the true history of humanity. Yeah. And I really feel like you have been divinely guided. I mean, I've been watching your series, your pirate treasure series with the Knights Templar. I mean, I'm just fascinated. And the fact that you just continue to keep finding artifacts and being able to connect Madagascar with Europe, with the Knights Templar, with Jesus and his bloodline. I mean, it goes right in line with Ralph Ellis. Are you familiar with him?
I know Ralph very well. I have never met Ralph, but we have corresponded for years. I've read all of his books. I think he's amazing, and I've tried to get him on the show. It just didn't work out for whatever reason, but I love his work.
I did
and,
too.
His latest book, On the Grail, have you seen that thing? It's about this thick.
I've heard about it. I don't have a lot of time to read, unfortunately, but I'm very familiar with his work because I have a very, very special connection with the Knights Templar. So anything to do with the Knights Templar, I'm on it, which is why I've been watching you. That's one of the reasons why I wanted to interview you.
Well, I guess I've become known as a world expert in the Knights Templar. I never thought about it that way. more from this sort of esoteric, mystical side, and of course the whole controversy with the Jesus and Mary Magdalene bloodline, which I realized the controversy behind it and why it's difficult for some people, but I wasn't raised with any religion in our home. My dad was a Freemason, and he just didn't expose me to any of that, so I didn't have any cleansing that I had to do of this BS story that the Roman Church has been preaching for 1700 years. So I didn't have to clean anything. I just look at the world in a pragmatic way and in dealing with a lot of really knowledgeable people. And I just want to make sure you make one thing clear. A lot of the research that I am talking about has been, the advancements that we've made have been in large part due to a large collaboration with many people that are doing related research. It's not all me.
Yes.
And I really like the fact, and I've always embraced this concept of sharing what I know with other people, like-minded people, because they're going to bring, this person's going to bring something, that person brings something else, and all of a sudden we have an epiphany discovery that I couldn't have made without that person and that person. So when you get people working together with a common purpose, it's amazing. You can go 100 times further than some territorial person working in the shadows by themselves.
I agree, and especially if it has anything to do with bringing the truth forward. I would like to ask you, why do you feel that the discovery of the Kensington runestones is so significant with your work in tracking down the connection with the Knights Templar and the Jesus bloodline?
Well, it's funny you ask that question because very recently, like in the last 2 months, I have made a profound discovery on the runestone. And that discovery was something that I guess I already knew, but I didn't fully understand and appreciate until I became initiated myself. But the carver was initiated in the ancient mysteries of Isis and Osiris.
Wow.
Yeah, and I can prove it.
I
haven't published this yet. I've written the paper. I've got it in my new book, but I haven't talked about it in public yet. I've talked about it to three different groups of Masonic organizations. One of them is an education lodge, and a lot of eyebrows were raised. And when they raise their eyebrows in the education lodge, that means you've got them. And so this is a profound discovery. And what I'm talking about is the message itself. When you read it as a narrative, it just doesn't make sense. I'll give you an example. For one day, we were fishing one day. We were fishing one day. What do you mean? Obviously, they were fishing every day to sustain themselves. So clearly, they're not going to take the time to carve that on this important land claim inscription. So what does it really mean? Well, I didn't understand what it meant, but clearly now, fisher of men is a reference to Jesus.
Very true. Gosh.
And so I know that's it. And of course, we have ABM on the runestone, three Latin letters, which of course was a problem for the scholars for a long time. Well, ABM with a punch on the lower right leg of the M is clearly a reference to the Magdalene, to his wife. And, you know, ABM, people say, well, this is a reference to Mother Mary. Well, that story didn't happen. So if it's not a reference to her, who is it? And, you know, in esoteric circles, as I'm sure you're aware, different symbols have different meanings depending on your point of view.
Yes.
It's definitely one of them. And in this case, it's a reference to the Magdalene for sure.
Well, so what is the significance of the hooked X and the, because you talk a lot about that.
The hooked X is really the key to the whole thing, because the hooked X is a symbol that nobody had ever seen. The scholars said, well, we've never seen that, so it must be a hoax. No, you've never seen it. That's all it means. And my geology proved to me, again, going back to logic, that if the runestone is genuine, there has to be an explanation for all these anomalies in the inscription, including the hooked X. And I just knew that, you know, for me, having done forensics now for 31 years, if there's one thing I've learned, people care, rocks don't. Rocks don't care. They don't have bad days. You can't hurt their feelings. They just are. So I trust them. It's not that I don't trust people. Well, actually, there's a lot of people I don't trust, but I think you get the point. I'm just saying. But anyway, you get the point. So by following the evidence trail of the language, the runes, it led right to the Cistercians, right to the Templars, right to Jerusalem, right to the Talpiot tomb, to the Jesus ossuary, and sitting front and center on the lid of his ossuary is the hooked X. Oh my God, I couldn't believe it, but there you go.
Unbelievable. And then elucidate us with the whole cross and skull, the crossbones and skull, because it's a totally different, it's a more positive, impression about the crossbones and skull.
Right. Well, I can see that you've done your homework, so I'm impressed. this goes back to the first century and the burial practices of a particular sect of Egypto-Jews, I will call them, of the Essene, Jesus's people. And basically what they would do is they had a unique burial practice where only the family could process the body of the deceased. And they would bring them into these underground tombs, and they would process, anoint the body with perfumes and oils, and then they would wrap them in a shroud, bring them inside the burial chamber, and place them on a bench or a shelf that was actually cut into the rock. And then they would leave the body there for 1 to 2 years. And then they would come back and collect the bones, and they would place them inside of a stone bone box that's, you know, only big enough so that the two largest bones in the body, the femurs, would fit in crossed, and then they would put the skull in last, and that's the origin of the skull and crossbones symbol. It is a symbol of death. It's a reminder of death and that life is short and to live it to the fullest, but it's also a symbol of reverence for Jesus and his people.
Amazing. Now, how does this relate to the Ankh?
Well, the Ankh is really nothing more than a tau cross with a handle on it. that's what it is. And the on this symbol that's on Jesus's ossuary is actual monogram of two symbols, the hooked X and the tau cross.
Oh my God.
Did you know this?
Yes. No, I do because I've researched you, but okay. I'm just amazed how there have literally been little morsels of breadcrumbs that you've just been finding one after the other to connect the dots on this.
It's what I do for a living. I mean, I'm a forensic investigator. That's what I do. So
fantastic.
Well, and you know what? I think sometimes people make things harder than they need to be. This was not easy. because you've got a group of people that were covering their tracks every step of the way.
I bet.
They were doing things in secret. I mean, this was a pretty high stakes game of poker with the Roman Catholic Church that they were ideologically opposed to, but yet had aligned themselves with them. You know, keep your friends close, your enemies closer. And that's exactly what they did. And in essence, we're talking about the greatest coup d'etat in history that nobody knows about. And, you know, when you read about the Templars and this whole dynamic from an academic standpoint, I mean, I laugh out loud at how much these people don't understand what they're dealing with.
Yeah.
And it's laughable. It really is. But anyway, getting back to the Tau Cross, on Jesus' ashram, we have both the Hooked X and the Tau Cross. And it's as a monogram. And what I suggested to the Israeli scholars is I've always believed, and I think I could prove, that the Hooked X, which is being used for the A sound in the five North American runestones, including the Kensington stone, that it's a straight line version of the Hebrew Aleph. If you look at the Aleph symbol, it looks like a Hooked X. And if you carve it with straight lines on a stone, that's what you get, the Hooked X. So, and the Tau is the last letter of the Hebrew alphabet. So I suggested that what this symbol is on Jesus' ossuary is the Alpha, Omega, beginning and end.
Yeah.
And they loved it. And
yeah.
So wow. I think that's what it is. But getting back to the Tau Cross, why the Tau Cross? Well, the Tau Cross is, in fact, I think it's a direct piece of evidence that ties Jesus' Egyptian heritage right back to Egypt. The Tau Cross, or the Ankh, as you were saying, is the most important symbol in Egyptian mythology. It's a symbol of life, it's a symbol of resurrection, and it goes back even farther back to its use as a nilometer. It was used to measure the height of the Nile in the spring, and it would tell the people if they were going to have famine, and you know, if it was low, if it was too high, they'd have flooding and famine, or if it hit right in the wheelhouse, they'd have prosperity among the people. So it was literally a predictor of life and death in Egypt. And so that's why it evolved into this most important symbol in Egyptian mythology. And there you have it on Jesus' ossuary. Are you kidding me? It's amazing.
You must feel so honored to be the one that's exposing this, number one. And I think what the audience is probably wondering right now is, how much resistance have you run into through your travels of revealing this sort of stuff? I kept thinking about that when I was watching your Templar series, as to why aren't there a whole bunch of people sitting over at the Isle of St. Marie, Isle of St. Marie or something?
That Ile St. Marie.
Yeah. Okay. I kept thinking, why aren't there so many people blocking you from discovering this?
Well, you know, I think there's a couple of reasons. I mean, first of all, let's face it, Dan Brown and Holy Blood, Holy Grail, the authors of that book, they took a lot of the early bullets. And so it's, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, those deep, dark family secrets, when they first come out, everybody's shocked. And then after 5 minutes, they go, okay, well, I guess we got to deal with it. Life goes on, right? And I think really that's where we're at right now. I mean, the whole idea of a Jesus bloodline, has anybody not heard that story?
Yeah, no, I don't think so.
And now what's happening is the evidence is starting to come forward that is, at this point, I mean, let's face it, it's done, okay? It's what happened. And, you know, again, as a pragmatist, as an investigator, you know what I say to people is I say, look, first of all, just dial back for a second. Think about it pragmatically, logically, okay? Everybody walking on the planet today, every last person, has ancestors that were around 2,000 years ago. Fact, okay? Why is it such a mystery or unbelievable to imagine that these two people would not have descendants alive today?
Sure.
We all have ancestors that, you know, had children. Why couldn't they and have those descendants walk on the planet today? And in fact, they do. It's not a difficult concept. It's not.
No. And there's a lot of ancient script that does continue to emphasize that the descendants were sent throughout the world. They were dispersed seven major continents so that they could spread the word. So, you know, I think that the other thing that's interesting that Ralph Ellis really points out, and we've all kind of known this, is that history has been rewritten by whom?
Oh, the winners.
Exactly. And yeah. And who do we trust? Do we trust the government who writes the history books in the schools? I mean,
yes, you know, I believe everything they say, anything they say is perfect.
And that's really what you're doing. You're just blowing holes in all of this it's just things and events that we have just accepted as fact that you're just blowing holes in all of it. I love it. I just love it.
Hey, you know what? My job is to get to the truth. That's what I do. That's what I've always done. And you know what? I've put people out of business that screwed up on a big project. I'm sorry, man. These are the results. You're a nice person. I wish it didn't happen to you. But it is what it is, and you got to deal with it, right?
Right.
And so if this is what the story is. I mean, what do you want from me? I mean, I don't make things up for anybody. I'm not smart enough to remember BS. I can barely remember the truth. So.
Well, hey, you know what? You were selected because you have the strength to withstand the controversy.
Yeah.
And be able to stand unwavering in the truth. That's why you're doing what you're doing. I wanted to ask you, how have you linked Jesus and his family to the Knights Templar?
Well, that's an easy one. If you follow the historical thread of the Merovingian families into southern France, and if you look at the names of the people who founded the Cistercians and were the original founders of the Knights Templar order, they're all part of the same families. You know, at some point we're going to be able to tie this all together with DNA. We know what the truth is, and these families know their own history. A lot of them know who they are and what their destinies have been. But, you know, there's another piece to this puzzle that sort of answers a lot of the questions that, you know, the question you asked about how do we put up with all the controversy and, you know, are you worried about people trying to keep you quiet, and I've never been worried about any of that stuff. But you know, I know you've heard this said before. People say, and I've heard the natives say this a lot, and Templar mystics say this to me a lot, that it's time that the truth came out. Well, that's all fine and dandy, but what the heck does that mean? And for a long time, I asked that question, and you know who helped me understand the answer was Ralph Ellis. Precession of the equinoxes and how we have just finished this time period of Pisces, the fish, the Fisher King that I mentioned before. And it's not just that we've finished this roughly 2000 year long period of the ages and precession and how the constellations, the 12 primary constellations of the zodiac move around us in the zodiacal belt, but we've also finished this 26,000 year long cycle, the end of the Mayan calendar, the end of the world, as the doomsayers would say, which was nonsense, of course. We've just started a brand new cycle, but it's important for a lot of reasons. And what I say in my lectures to people is I go, we just lived through one of the most profound moments in human history and nobody gets it yet.
Yes.
But absolutely. It's a time of I mean, you know what I'm talking about. It's a time of profound change. And so this whole idea that it's time that the truth came out. And lo and behold, look what's happening. The Catholic Church is dying in front of our eyes. And all this new information is coming out because it's supposed to, I guess. And
well, it has to, Scott. It has to.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, and I agree because, let's face it, we're killing our planet. We're killing ourselves. And, you know, the main thrust of this is, in my opinion, is keeping, you know, the oil-based world economy going. And it's a select few that are benefiting beyond what they need and controlling the situation. And they're only going to change it when they have to.
Yeah.
And you think we'd be smart enough to realize, okay, we need to do things differently. We have the technology. So sure. Let's just do it.
But, yeah, well, and that's what we're being faced with is we need to get it right this time, and we need to react differently to that which we see as the blemish and the miscreation in this planet. This is one of those blemishes, which is all of the real true history has been hidden from us.
Yeah.
And you're one of those, you know, pieces of the puzzle that's exposing that reality. I think it's wonderful. I have a question for you. You know, they say that there were a core 9 men who started and initiated the Knights Templar. Do you feel that those are the core nine bloodlines?
Well, we know who they are. I have not personally spent a lot of time digging into the genealogy of these people.
Okay.
I would say that they were all part of it for sure. Mm-hmm. Now, were they representing nine different tribes or nine different family groups? I'm not sure. I know that Hugh de Payen was directly connected. He was an uncle of Bernard de Clairvaux, who was the one that launched the Cistercians to meteoric success. And, it's interesting. No important decision in Christendom and in politics during his lifetime was made by anybody without his counsel, including popes. And the funny thing is that if he was so Catholic, as some people want to suggest, he could have become pope anytime he wanted, yet he never did.
Mm.
Why not? Well, the reason's obvious, because he wasn't Catholic. Yeah. But anyway, and he didn't need to. He still had the power and the control to be the puppet master for the events that played out.
I was going to say he probably had a lot more freedom in the position that he was holding. Versus,
well, he was the guy, and in my opinion, I think Bernard de Clairvaux was arguably the most important historical figure in the history of the world, and hardly anybody knows who he was. Yeah. It's amazing, really.
So how does all of this link with your Pirate Treasure series that's coming out? And by the way, everybody, if you haven't been watching it, it is incredible. Check it out. It's on his series. And tell me exactly the right title.
It's called Pirate Treasure of the Knights Templar.
Okay.
And I was actually brought into that show that was already underway to help bring in that Templar angle. And I'll tell you what, I couldn't have dreamed that it would go as well as it did. I mean, and everything that you saw that I did, I mean, they had these places they wanted me to go, but it all evolved and was discovered as it happened. I mean, it wasn't a
concise. That's the part that's so cool about it.
Yeah, it was great. But there was a lot of controversy surrounding that series as well, because, as you know, UNESCO went in and they basically said, oh, this isn't Captain Kidd's treasure and he's doing everything wrong and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, Barry's an interesting guy. He's an older guy. He's an old ship captain and he likes to have his way. And so he tends to butt heads with people sometimes that he doesn't see eye to eye. He and I got along just fine. But UNESCO had it out for him. And, you know, and timing sometimes works in weird ways. But when I was in Madagascar, he did not have the permits to be able to dive. I was supposed to dive on these wrecks too, but I didn't get a chance to because when I was there, we couldn't get in the water. So I spent time on Madagascar trying to kill time so that they could get the permits. But eventually, after about a week, we had to go. And then they got the permit. And then he found the silver bar. Well, I was the one that noticed on the silver bar the triple tau.
I know. I just couldn't believe that.
Yeah, I couldn't either, you know. And then, of course, there was all this controversy with, well, it's UNESCO said, well, it's lead, it's not silver. And, you know, that's somehow that diminishes its importance. And I said, first of all, in context with the age of 1700 and in the pirate culture, lead was actually more valuable than silver, because they used it for lead shot in their weapons, right?
Right.
And they often used, at that time, silver as ballast in the ship. So it wasn't like gold. It wasn't even anywhere close to it. And you could make a case that lead was actually more important than silver at the time, but yet we think about it in the 21st century context, and you can't do that. But at the end of the day, it didn't matter to me if it was silver or lead. It was the symbol that was on the stone that led to the discoveries in India. So it was just amazing. I mean, it worked out for me perfectly.
Now tell the audience about the Tau Cross.
Yeah.
And how this fits in with that piece of lead that was found underwater. And
yeah,
this was found, right? This was found with the Adventure Galley.
The Adventure Galley, yep. That was Captain Kidd's ship. And you know, a lot of people are like, wow, what was he doing in Madagascar? Well, it was a well-known place where people could hang out and repair their ships and get a little R&R. You know, the ship company, I'm drawing a blank on the, but they used to, the patrol ships used to from England and other parts of Europe would patrol the western coast of Africa. So the pirates didn't hang out there too much, and they wanted to be sure that they were protecting the ships that were bringing back the most precious cargo from Africa, slaves. But on the eastern side, where Madagascar was, the ships weren't patrolling looking for pirates, so they had free rein over there, and that's why they would hang out there. Well, Captain Kidd is known to have scuttled the Adventure Galley there. That's not a mystery. That's a fact.
Yeah.
But nobody had ever found it yet because there's a whole bunch of shipwrecks there. And how do you figure out whose is what? Because it's so damn far away, nobody could really, you know, have access to the area. Well, Barry, I think he did find the Adventure Galley. I don't care what UNESCO says. I think the evidence is compelling. And he found, you know, the lead bar, and he, you know, he said there's a lot more there. He just brought them up.
So, I love that little green. It almost looked like jade.
Yeah, yeah.
Didn't it?
Well, there was stone, there was wood, there was ivory pieces, there was all kinds of stuff. Porcelain, glass.
So now, what was the connection between Captain Kidd and the Knights Templar? You mentioned that you have compelling evidence that he was doing something secretly, like a secret mission.
Right. Well, I don't know if he was necessarily a member of the Order of Christ. I don't think that he was, but whether he was a Freemason at the time, dealing with a lot of the Freemasons back at that time were people who were a member of certain secret societies, Rosicrucians and some of the others were well-known wealthy guys that were dealing in various business operations, making money like crazy. And they did things under the radar. And a lot of the stuff they were doing wasn't what we would consider cool at the time. They were, making money hand over fist, doing things under the radar, as it were, and paying people off to do certain things. A lot of people that we would be surprised if we knew who their names were. I think Captain Kidd got caught up in some of that. I don't think he's completely innocent of all charges. I don't think he was this notorious pirate that he was made out to be. But in this cabal of wealthy business people, many of whom were Freemasons operating, clandestinely, mm-hmm. He just became expendable, and they took him out. I think that's really what happened. So, but when he ended up over in the Indian Ocean in India, Madagascar, and in that area, he was dealing in the same area that the Order of Christ was dealing in, and there may have been some conflict there. So the Order of Christ was the Knights Templar. I mean, this is one of the myths that has been perpetrated by academia for a long time. I mean, after 1307, that was it. The Templars ceased to exist. That's BS.
Yeah, totally. I agree with that, with all the research I've done as well.
Well, it's a fact. I mean, I can tell you, I mean, in Portugal alone, the King and Queen of Spain, that was their army. And they were fighting the Moors who were attacking from the south. And when the put down came down and Pope said, you have to disband, the King and Queen said, are you kidding me? I'm not going to disband my army. It's not happening. So to appease the church, they simply changed their name to the Order of Christ. They continued on. And in fact, the Knights Templar Order, as an official order under a different name, continued for another 500 plus years in Portugal until they were disbanded in 1835. So, the prevailing thought and wisdom of the Knights Templar is just wrong. My job is to get things right. It's not about getting what I want. People think, oh, you're just doing this because it proves your theories. No.
I'm doing it because it's right.
It happens to prove my theories. Well, good for me. I mean, what do you, you know, it is what it is.
Well, Scott, you know, there is a prophecy from the Knights Templar directly that states that I believe it was in 700 years they would surface again. And that was in August of 2013.
Well, there's not a lot of people know about this guy. They've heard of something called the Malachi prophecy. Mm. And I love the Malachi prophecy. Brother Malachi was the closest confidant of Bernard de Clairvaux. Bernard sent Malachi to found the first Cistercian Abbey in Ireland on the lands that are now what they called their lands, they called their granges.
And on that grange at Mellifont that he founded is Newgrange, the megalithic site Newgrange. Have you heard of it?
Mm-mm.
Oh, look it up. It's more amazing than Stonehenge.
Cool.
And it's World Heritage Site. There's actually three sites, Mouth, Doubt, and Newgrange. Look it up. You'll go, oh my God.
Oh, I know what you're talking about. Yeah, I do. I have, yes.
It's a Venus chamber. Everybody thinks it's a solar chamber, but it's actually aligned to the planet Venus. And it was on the Cistercians' lands. And anyway, so Malachy, in the middle of the 12th century, said this. In 2012, the current pope would resign. The new pope would not be from the old world. He would be from the new world. And he would be the last pope. He's 2 for 3 so far. And people have asked me, they say, well, how can he be the last pope? Well, I'll tell you what I think could happen. If this whole story about the bloodline of Jesus and Mary is true, the reason that the first pope, Paul, was founded is because the leader of the church, Jesus, had been killed, right?
Mm-hmm.
And there was no succession, right? Well, what if somebody comes forward and they can prove their genealogical heritage to Jesus and they say, I'm retaking over leadership of the Roman, of the Christian church, not Roman. All of a sudden, there's no need for a pope, is there?
Mm-mm. Well, and on top of that, what do you think about the fact that when they did discover a lot of the archaeological artifacts under the dome of the rock, and supposedly it took them something like 9 months to not only travel to the Vatican, but tie things up with the Vatican, quote, where they were to present something that was notorious and historical to the Vatican?
Well, we'll never see those documents. Well, I guess I shouldn't say that, but...
That remains a mystery, supposedly, to this day.
Well, it's not a mystery. I'll reserve comment on that, but I will say that I could probably tell you an awful lot about that story.
Cool. Well, we'll definitely have to have you back on for that.
Well, you know, it's interesting. If you look at symbolism, you can learn an awful lot about the way the Templars operated, about the way history has unfolded by looking at certain things. One of the things that people should pay attention to is the number 9.
Yes.
9 knights, 9 levels under the temple. What, you know, there's a lot of, on the face side of the Kensington inscription, there are 9 lines of text, 3 on the side for a total of 12. Is that a coincidence? No.
This is the 9-year, 2016.
There's all kinds of examples that I can show you. And there's a reason for it. And I'm going to talk about what those reasons are in the new book. I've got some revelations that are coming up in this new book that's going to make your hair stand on end. And it's all supported by factual evidence. But at the same time, now that I have been initiated, I understand the other language, and I'm going to teach people a little bit about that, how they can use it, how they can read things that they couldn't read before that were hidden in plain sight the whole time.
That is so fabulous. Oh my God. I mean, I'm telling you, everybody's going to be salivating to learn about our lineage.
Well, you know what? You hit the nail on the head. The one thing that I would say about these people, the bloodline that we call the Venus families, that eventually evolved into the Templars and then into modern Freemasonry, but one of their main tenets that is so important to, it's always been important, it's even more important today, is seek light, seek knowledge. If you look at some of these big movers and shakers that are part of these Venus families, they were the ones that put their money to build universities and colleges and institutions of education.
Yes.
Because at the end of the day, let's face it, the biggest problem this world faces today is overpopulation. And the way that we're going to get this thing back into balance isn't by killing people, it's through education. It's a fact that the more educated women are, the fewer number of children they have. And that has been the antithesis of things like the Roman Church that wants to, you know, I don't have to tell you what they did to women. And I think that is part of what has created the mess that we have today.
Now, you know, now speaking of the Catholic Church, do you feel that there is another hidden element of the church, another tangent of perhaps the Illuminati that is really trying to help people like you to expose the truth?
I can tell you that the biggest supporters that I have been the Freemasons. And they're supposed to be the ones that are running the world and don't want a guy like me to expose these things that they're supposedly covering up. Mm-hmm. I can tell you that the Freemasons I've interacted with, and I've interacted with some top-level people, that's not what they're about. They support me like you can't imagine. They have let me into their libraries. They have shared many secrets with me. And they've said, look, you can. There's nothing you can't talk about. And believe me, if they said, don't talk about it, I wouldn't. I've never been threatened. I've been insulted. But it's by people. Most of it's been driven by fear, quite frankly. And I don't worry about it. Call me all the names you want. When you're done calling me names, do you want to talk about the evidence? You want to screw around some more? Just let me know when you're ready. It doesn't bother me. It doesn't.
Hey, for most of us watching you, we know you've been divinely chosen to take this task on hand. Seriously, it's not an easy feat to jump into something where you're blowing open every single belief system about the core of our history. And the fact that you're exposing that in the United States of America, because so much emphasis is placed on Europe, on Africa, on Asia. You know, there's, you know, all we're ever told when we're brought up in this country, at least, is, oh, we're such a young nation. We don't have a lot of history here. This is what we've been told over and over.
No. Well, listen, talk to Native Americans. They'll tell you something completely different. And, you know, and I'll give myself credit for one thing. Early on, I said to myself, well, look, if these guys were coming over here, who would know? The natives, and they know all about the people that were coming here, not just the Templars. They know about the Vikings. They know about all these cultures that came back here for thousands of years. And, you know, I mean, people say, well, why don't they say anything? I go, well, why do you think? Look at what they went through.
Yeah.
The Templars warned them. They said the Christians are coming and it isn't going to be good. And guess what? It wasn't really good, was it?
No.
So Native Americans, they don't really care what white people think for obvious reasons. But I will say this, if you reach out to them in a respectful way, respect their culture and listen, they're like anybody else. You treat people with respect and, you know, they can see through BS. They can tell if you're a genuine person. And if they trust you, they've told me some amazing things. I believe every word of it because it makes sense. And their oral traditions are not the telephone game. It's a very important thing in their culture that for a person to receive this ancient knowledge, first of all, it's an honor and a privilege to be selected.
Yes.
And it's associated with ritual where there's sound, there's light, there's joy, there's pain. It's a multi-sensory experience. And the analogy that I use is, especially I say to women, do you remember the day that you gave birth? Well, yeah. Well, why?
Well, besides the fact that you brought life into the world, there was a lot going on, right?
And you were being bombarded. All of your senses were being bombarded. And it was the most profound moment probably in your life. Mm-hmm. Well, it's not the same thing. But when people hear these oral stories, there's a lot going on. It's an honor. It's a privilege. It's not the telephone game.
Yeah.
And so we need to trust those people, but we have to earn that trust first.
Yeah, and actually, with a lot of the ancient mystery schools and a lot of the ancient text, most of this information that's key today in assisting us in our enlightenment stages, okay, It was all passed down from master to student, from teacher to student.
Mouth to ear.
Always.
Yep.
Always.
Yep. So this is why, now in fairness to the skeptics and the academics that have a problem with this, first of all, their brains aren't wired that way. And I get it because I have sort of that scientist academic side to me, but I also have this other side that I call my spidey sense, I guess you would say. I mean, it's intuition. We all have it. It's just a matter of how tapped into it you are. And, you know, I'm not as tapped into it as I should be, but I do try to listen to it. But a lot of these people that have a difficult time with this just aren't wired that way. And so they tend to reject something that they don't understand or they just can't figure out. And, you know, getting back to the runestone for a second, this epiphany discovery that we had upon initiation and realizing the person that wrote this was also initiated and used allegory, code, and symbolism within the inscription. If you're not initiated, you have no chance of figuring this out. And what has happened for the last 118 years now, the scholars have struggled with the runestone because they don't understand these concepts, at least not to the level that they need to be able to get to the bottom of this inscription and this mystery. So I can't stress the importance of this. And if I had never become initiated, there was always that last piece of the puzzle that I knew was out there that I just didn't understand. And now to fully understand it, it is so cool.
I know. And that link back to Osiris and Isis, oh my God.
Wait till you hear it. Wait till you hear it. But you got to come to the conference. Sorry, can't do it today.
Well, you know, they've offered me tickets, so I'm considering drive. I don't know. It's quite the haul from where I live, so we'll see.
Well, you know what? Once you get in the car, you throw on the tunes, you get there in no time. It'll be worth it, I promise.
Well, I'll look you up if I get up there.
You bet.
So tell me a little bit before we tie things up. We've got about 8 minutes here. Tell me a little bit about your book.
Okay. Well, I have actually three books that deal with the subject matter that I've already published. The first one you mentioned is called The Kensington Runestone, Compelling New Evidence. That one was published in 2006.
The next book was called The Hooked X, Key to the Secret History of North America. That came out in 2009.
My latest book is called Akhenaten to the Founding Fathers, The Mysteries of the Hooked X. And really what that does is goes back to Egypt, brings it through Jesus and all the way to the founding fathers, because that's the thread. That's the historical thread. It's an ideological thread that is symbolized by the Hooked X. And it's good stuff. And now, since that book came out in 2013, you know, the Hooked X Tau Cross on the Jesus Ashram, my God. If somebody said to me, okay, Scott, you can pick anywhere in the world, anytime, anything you want, you just tell us, when you get to the bottom of the well with the Hooked X, where would you like to find it? I couldn't have picked where I found it. It was better than anything I could have dreamed. And I don't know how you can deny it. Every single scholar, biblical scholar that I gave my explanation to about this, they all agreed. Every one of them said, you know what? Alpha, Omega, yeah, you got it. So that was amazing. And now with this new discovery in the runestone, this new book that'll come out in about a year, it's going to be crazy. Hey, can I plug just a couple of the quick things?
Sure. Go for it.
I encourage people, whether you're a skeptic or a supporter or you're in the middle somewhere, I don't care. Come to my blog, scottwalteranswers.blogspot.com. You'll see the trolls and all their comments and all their sarcasm and all their BS, but I let them post and I respond to them. And then, of course, there's plenty of supporters and people all over. But I say to people, look, I don't learn things from people who agree with everything I say.
Sure.
But again, if you're just going to come on here and troll and call us names and criticize the material, I'll let you post for a while and then I'll flush you. But if you have a dissenting comment or you have criticism that has some support, I want to hear it. I really do. The other thing is we have a website where you can see the books and see a lot of photos. It's www.hookedx.com, HOOKEDX.com. Check that out. And one more thing. I want to plug my wife's new book. It's called America, Nation of the Goddess. She co-authored the book with Alan Butler. We just had a Skype call talking about new research with Alan. He's coming over here in a couple of weeks with his wife, Kate, and we're going to meet them on the East Coast and do a speaking tour. And I can't wait to meet Alan. But that book just came out in December, and it's awesome. The reviews are great. It really piggybacks on Akhenaten Founding Fathers, because it talks about America here, which is the nation of the goddess. And if you don't believe me, read the book.
Awesome. And just one last question. Was Akhenaten somebody that was not positive and beneficial for humanity, in your opinion, after everything you found?
No, he was the opposite. Akhenaten was the one who changed the religion from polytheistic dualism in Egypt to monotheistic dualism in Egypt. Basically, he changed from venerating the setting sun to the Aten, venerating the rising sun. And it was, in some ways, it's like, well, what's the difference? Well, there's a big difference. But when you look at, you know, the crossed crook and flail on his chest, what people don't realize is not only does that symbolize the hooked X, but it also symbolizes Akhenaten's attempt to unite the two religions. The flail herds the bulls, the followers of Taurus, the old religion. And the crook herds the rams, the sheep of Aries, the new religion. Mm-hmm. And again, this gets back to precession. He came into power when the age changed from Taurus the bull and the Apis bull worship of old Egypt to Aries the ram, the new religion. And that that cross, crook, and flail on his chest represents his attempt to unite the two religions. It failed. His followers were driven out. That's the Exodus. And eventually weaves into John the Baptist and Jesus and that whole story. I mean, it's a continuous thread. That's our history. That is our history in this country.
That is awesome.
I love it.
I'm sorry, what'd you say, Scott?
He was a positive player. It was all good.
Good, good. I'm glad to hear it. And I am so jazzed to talk to you just because you're so great at connecting the dots. It's something that most people that are on the internet and doing a lot of research and seeking truth, this is truly what we're constantly striving to accomplish, is connecting right. The dots and trying to make some headway as to intuitively, does this really feel right? And the one thing I really want to stress to anybody that's out there, if you're reading anything about any of us that are of a so-called higher profile, step back and remember the adage, I think thou doth protest too much. If there is that much controversy and that much negativity written about a particular individual, then you really should step back and realize that we're in an inverted reality, and that which should be is not at this point in time. That's why we're all here, is to bring this truth to the light. So please support Scott. He will be, again, at the San Mateo County Event Center, and that's from April 29th through May 1st. And it sounds like a phenomenal workshop that you're giving. Please support him, and you can check him out again at Scott Walter's Answers. Scott Walter Answers.
Scott Walter Answers.
Answers. blogspot.com
And come on, I'll tell you what, I've got some wonderful blogs. I would write a blog after every show, and we got everything covered. There's a lot of great stuff there, but the last few threads have been about some of the things we've talked about when the big discoveries have happened that are really tying this all together. And one thing I will say, you brought up a really good point, connecting the dots is very important. But as a forensic person, our job is to go out there and collect the evidence to try to see if it all fits. If you have a piece of evidence that's hanging out there, doesn't fit the thread, you're not there yet. And I can tell you that this myriad of collection of evidence that we have, it all fits. That's how you know you're on the right track. That's how forensics work. And believe me, if there's one thing I'll pat myself on the back on, I know how to do forensics, and this has been the most challenging thing I've ever worked on, but I think we're finally there, and it is what it is, and I just tell people, deal with it, because you're going to have to.
No, and I truly, we want to thank you, Scott, for literally marrying science with spiritual history. I think that's what you're really, truly bringing forth. And I think people are going to be so excited as they start digging more into the work that you're doing. So thank you. Stay tuned, and we'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, hey, thanks for having me.
Bye-bye. Good afternoon, everyone. This is Alexandra from GalacticConnection.com. And today I have Danyon Brinkley with me. If you don't already know who he is, he's an author of The Secrets of the Light, Saved by the Light, and At Peace in the Light. He is loved and respected worldwide for the inspirational lectures on his near-death experience, I should say experiences, and his hospice care, and his alternative healing practices, self-awareness. He's been really on a journey to teach people breathing techniques to cope with their issues of disease, as well as how they can pass, not die, to the other side and recognize it's one of the greatest gifts in the world to go through. Danyon has worked diligently looking for the best way to integrate conventional and complementary medicine, and he has survived numerous brushes with death. He's an expert in the dying process, and he was literally struck twice by lightning. How that's possible, I'll never know. And the first lightning strike radically changed his life. Danyon became a hospice and nursing home volunteer, and in the past 25 years of volunteer service, he has been at the bedside of over 340 people, how cool is that, at the point of death, and more than 1,200 during their final days, accruing more than 16,000 hours of service, and I bet it's even more than that. So welcome, Danyon, and I wanted everyone to know that Danyon will be appearing at the New Living Expo in San Mateo, California, at the San Mateo County Event Center. He will be speaking on The Clash of the Paradigms. I love that title. And that will be on May 1st, right? From noon to 1:30. Okay.
And I have a couple of other panels, Alexandra, but the Clash of the Paradigms is if you die or if you don't. And the redefinition, the redefining of death as an issue becomes very important to we who are baby boomers, born between 1940 and 1967.
Cool.
Okay. And as we enter this paradigm, it's going to affect people who are younger than us in this age group, but it's going to affect us more dramatically.
Interesting.
When
40 to 67?
Well, because that's the baby boomers.
Okay.
The largest expanded birth rate in the history of Western consciousness happened between 1940 and 1967. More children were born worldwide in the Western world at that particular time than ever. So there's roughly 76 million were born in America. 76 million were born in America. And now we have green cards and people who've become American citizens. So we're right around 80 million people. If you look at the demographics of that, realizing that if 10,000 are turning 65 every day, the average life expectancy of a male in America is 75.4 years, and a woman is 81.2.
Wow.
So like it or not, 15 million of your friends, aunts, uncles, parents, cousins, brothers, sisters, neighbors will pass. How well are you prepared to deal with this in the next 10 to 11 years?
So, you know, Danyon, they've talked about how there will be such a large number passing because of all the immense energies coming in right now. They won't have enough of a vibrational frequency to handle these energies.
That's why I say between 11 and 15 million.
Wow.
We are in the shift. There is no question. If you look at it from the Mayan point of view, it is definitely in the last 3 years of the transitional period from December the 12th, 2012. It positions itself sometime in mid-April 2017. Then there's the shakeout, and then we're into the next period. Okay, that's 300 years, but you know the Mayans work probably 29 years at a shot. So this presidential election will affect the next 29 years of history, and it will see a complete disruption. And we will see a complete disruption and literally maybe a complete change in the shift in consciousness of the Western world. Probably a collapsing empires, probably the devaluation of fiat currency, but even more important, all of this is done, Alexandra, because people are being programmed not to be sensitive. The powers that be does not want us to be calm enough to be able to sit quietly and meditate, pay attention to our breathing, and find that initial action that allows us to elevate our consciousness into a higher spiritual wellness. If you keep you frightened, you keep you scared, you keep breaking the economy, you put yourself $20 trillion in debt, and you don't know how you're going to live paycheck to paycheck, which is 90% of us, then you're never going to stop to meditate and pray. One thing I'm lucky about, we were talking earlier, everything to me, I base it on how entertaining it is. So why I love my wife so very much is she's the most entertaining woman I have ever met, because I am fortunate enough to know what comes next. So if I didn't die and I didn't go to hell, nobody's going to die and nobody's going to go to hell. And so the argument of these two paradigm shifts, we are great, powerful, and mighty spiritual beings, and we have dignity, direction, and purpose. So the only thing that could have ever gone wrong in our lives, if we have allowed something to affect our dignity, which is religions, institutions, or governments, they're trying to keep us from paying attention to what religions, institutions, and governments have done to affect our dignity. And me, I'm on the front lines of looking at the paradigm shift, looking at the clash, looking at what yesterday, we're too smart to realize that yesterday's paradigm is gone and a new one's coming. And the most important point about that is this. In the 60s, the Beatles gave us Yogananda, some Indian sitting on a mountain in the Himalayas contemplating his navel, teaches us about transitional meditation, you know, and we all had a guru, and the guru said we're all one, you know, and then people start trying to comprehend being all one. But today we have CERN, we have theoretical quantum dynamics, and the Higgs boson particle has been discovered. And they've recreated an example of it. And it shows that we all float in something we call dark matter. I think that's an interesting title for God. But
yeah, I saw that before.
Because outer space is dark, so they call it dark matter. So we are all really connected.
It's almost like being in the womb, flowing in the amniocentesis. Yeah, thank you.
Fluid.
I can't speak today. So, Danyon, tell me a little bit about how did you get here? How did you get here right at this moment today? What has been your burning desire in the last 26 years?
Well, what it was to accomplish two things. I wrote in Saved by the Light 20 years ago or 21 years ago, and I've said this since 1975. I think I had two purposes. The purpose was to create spiritualistic capitalism, which is because it's godless capitalism. And spiritualistic capitalism is to find something to do with your life that empowers humankind. This is the most important, Alexandra, this is the most important thing that anybody can realize. When you leave this world, you're going to have what is called a panoramic life review. You're going to see your whole life pass before you in a 360-degree panorama. You're going to watch it from a second-person point of view as if you were your own best friend. Wow, that was really smart, Alexandra. Wow, what were you thinking, crazy? And then you're going to literally become every person that you've ever encountered, and you're going to feel the direct results of your interaction between you and every person. You're not only going to become them, but you're going to feel the direct results. That is imperative. It's not what you're doing, but why you're doing it. And in the end, this is a Danyonism. If you want to know what the meaning of life is, if God couldn't come today and God sent you in the life you just reviewed, what difference did you and God make? Nothing else matters. So I started writing books and doing lectures and touring and taking part of that money, and I founded the Twilight Brigade with Catherine's help. I founded the Twilight Brigade, which is now one of the largest end-of-life care volunteer programs for dying veterans in the history of this country.
That is so fabulous.
That is spiritualistic capitalism. I was just in West LA at the bedside of dying veterans. I just came home last night. I've lost 15 of some guys I've known for 6 years. I have 32,000 hours at the bedside, and I've been with 2,008 people and 300 now, 343 people taking their last breath. And the last one was Saturday afternoon, just last Saturday afternoon. So,
you know, Daniel, you said something about dignity. It's very sad that particularly in the Western region, we don't have a sense of dignity when it comes to passing. And it feels very refreshing to see that that's like one of your causes, is to bring that sense of dignity to the whole process of passing.
Well, we're afraid. We keep hoping Jesus or some story that's 2,000 years old, that, you know, if you look at the Bible, they just discovered the oldest Bible. It's like 1,900 years old. And the religious world here uses the King James Version. So they just finished a study doing a comparison of what the King James Version says and what the oldest written Bible, which is probably in Hebrew and Aramaic. There is 14,800 changes in the King James Version from the original.
Well, I totally believe that.
14,800. Okay, so when we start to look at this mindset, we hide from it and we go to church hoping we're going to be good. But if God couldn't come today and God sent you, and in the life you're about to review, what difference did you and God make? That means the purpose of this life is somewhere in some almost unbelievable task that the divine has given you, you have succeeded. And the opportunity of the lifetime is to be born into this physical world. This is the gift. We have achieved such co-creative identity and respect and dignity that we are allowed to create life here. We can have children. We can plant gardens. We can feed ourselves. We have an autonomic breathing system that moves. We have a vascular system. We have an endocrine system. We have a cannabinoid system that regulates and cleanses this body. And when people get so caught up, Alexandra, in this reality, if you take a good look at yourself, you're 76% water. That means you're just basically a water treatment plant. Okay? And we get so caught up in that. I have to fight the fight about the dignity. The most underserved population is the dying because everybody's afraid of it. I have been a hospice volunteer for 38 years, and I've been dead myself. There's nothing about the process I don't know. And Kat says, you know, that's awful arrogant and narcissistic. I said, well, I say that so that somebody will come out and say they know as much or more than me so I can sit down and have a conversation with them to learn and grow and be better, not to ostracize anyone.
I was going to ask you, what would you say are the core fears when someone is in the process of passing?
Going to hell.
Really? And number one, anything else?
Guilt, unresolved issues.
Okay. Anything else?
Pain.
Okay.
People are more afraid of pain than they are afraid of the actual event.
Wow.
Because the closer they get to the actual event, because the advancements in cardiopulmonary resuscitation techniques, pharmacology, and what we now know about how the body works, you can be dead for 2 years and we can keep you alive. In 1975, if you had no oxygen to your brain for 5 minutes, you were considered dead. Well, I had no oxygen to my brain for 28 minutes, so that helped explain part of my problem. But the rest of this, now they're resuscitating people up to 100 minutes.
Wow.
2.5 hours. So in National Geographic, April is on the near-death experience, and it's called Redefining Death. I highly recommend everybody to go get a copy of National Geographic and realize that we are mainstream. And why so many people, we were talking earlier, so many people are using the near-death experience to frame their spiritual happenings or to create attention so that other people pay attention, because NDE comes into play as an acceptable, mystical, magical, ethereal paradigm to put whatever you are, you put whatever event that you say you've had or has happened to you, so that people listen.
I was going to ask you, there's so much controversy within the spiritual community about seeing the tunnel of light at the point of passing. And many are saying that it can actually be a diversionary tactic. Like it's to keep you in the reincarnation system. What do you feel about that?
Well, but you got to look. Lucifer, Satan, the devil, Lucifer, the morning star. You know, when everybody asks me about the devil, I always say that I sincerely believe that the devil's been in the witness protection program because he has so many names. And I've heard all of that, you know. I've heard all of that stuff. And
make me laugh.
But listen, I don't, I didn't die any of the three times, and I never went to hell. So I think everything's funny. And my place is this. If it isn't funny, it isn't spiritual. And if you want to talk to me about God and you're not going to make me laugh, you need to keep that to yourself, because I am no longer interested, because the places that I have traveled in these three journeys have been sensual, emotional, loving, and caring. Like if you cut your foot and you're 6 years old and you cut your foot and mom picks you up, sets you on top of the washing machine, cleans the little cut, puts that little Band-Aid on it, and the whole world is perfect. You are that way the whole time you're over there. And the thing that's so cool about it, you are aware of the divine flow, but you realize that the divine flow is aware of you. So the term loneliness, abandoned, these terms don't exist over there. Somebody said, what do you think is the most important thing over there? Abandonment and loneliness, which eliminates despair, does not exist in that dimensional level of existence.
You also mentioned emotional, which most people would not equate passing to the other side of the veil with emotion.
Yeah, but you know, people have to start to look at, in the early transitional points, emotions are attitudes. Emotion is a mental concept about something we like or don't like. Over there, you have an emotional side because you're letting go of a socio-psychological and a socio-psychiatric identity that you've developed. This is what's the funny thing. Nobody knows who the hell they are. Okay? All right? Who are you? You're a collective psychological constructed identity based on what other people like about you. Okay?
Wow.
That's what you are. All right? But the very moment you get through the tunnel, that stuff becomes nonsense. You return to the ethereal being that you are. You hold yourself in dignity and grace, and you're willing to face your life, see what the lessons were, where you made your mistakes, how do you correct it and identify it, because nothing is going to save you. You know, they say that at the end, and I don't like to push religion around because I think it serves some purpose. It makes us crazier. But to think that somebody's going to forgive you and die for your sins, that's the biggest bunch of nonsense I have ever heard. Because the only person you can be saved from is yourself. And the only person who can save you from yourself is you. And you cannot do it out of fear.
That's awesome. So what happens after you've gone through your review? Where do you go from there? Is there a typical modus operandi?
You go back to where you come from. We don't all come from the same place. In Genesis, it says there are seven heavens. Okay, I know of four because in my three journeys over a 22-year period, struck by lightning and then struck by lightning again. I didn't have a near-death experience the second lightning strike. That means I was catching on. You know, they have to kill me every 10 or 15 years to keep me. I'm kind of like ADHD when it comes to being dignified.
And you got to have lightning to wake you up?
Yeah, well, you know, that's a... Think about this, Alexandra.
That's crazy.
Hey, watch this. Here's how cool God is. Lightning, in legal terms, is an act of God. If somebody gets struck by lightning and you've sued them because of whatever the circumstances is, it's an act of God. Okay, so I had electrocution. That's my spiritual self. And then I had, 13 years later, then I had open heart surgery.
Oh, my God.
That's my heart.
Heart.
And then 7 years later, I had brain surgery. That's mental, physical, and spiritual. So each of these experiences correlate with the point of consciousness that relates mental, physical, and spiritual.
Sure.
And this is my sense of humor about God. Think of this. I was struck by lightning on September 17th at 7.05 p.m. on a Wednesday afternoon during a thunderstorm. And the lightning hit me here.
Oh, my God.
I had brain surgery on September 17th at 7.05 a.m.
Wow.
Wednesday morning during a thunderstorm. And the first hole they drilled in my head was here.
Oh, my God. Did they have to drill a tunnel?
Well, I just go to show you the divine sense of humor. And I tell that story because it's a true story.
That's wild.
I went through 6 hours of surgery. I spent 41 hours in recovery because they couldn't come bring me back. When I came back, I had a massive grand mal seizure. I went into cardiac arrest and was put on life support in the neurocardiac ward because what normally happens is you have blood clots from what they were doing. And if a blood clot got in the prosthesis valve I have in my heart, they were going to have to do open heart surgery and brain surgery, and they were just waiting for the strokes. Well, I got through it because we are the privilege of living in this world, in this life, at this transitional period is the greatest gift that anyone breathing could have. And without locking into that as the absolute unadulterated truth, you never allow yourself to see what you're capable of achieving in this transitional period. Because the flux and multiple waves of knowledge and insight and elevation come. I have no problems crossing between dimensions. I mean, I do it all the time. And
yeah.
Who come to my lectures, they see. I pick people out of the audience. I tell them their life story. I have no problems of being able to take the pattern of what I call conscious breathing and to take that pattern. And in the course of taking that pattern, I can pick up who they are and interact with them. I never wanted to frame myself like James von Prague and John Edward, and I never wanted to be that person, although I am that person. But I needed the Veterans Administration and the federal government to recognize me. If I'm on tour reading minds and talking to the dead, they're going to blow me off.
Mm-hmm.
And my job was to institute what's called functional medicine, but to create a pathway of centers, a series of an 8-step program that allows people who are in transition or people who are grieving afterwards. You know, you have bereavement, which is a natural course of transition, but then you have grief and it can last a lifetime.
Oh, yeah.
And so I'm done. I'm putting all the equipment together. I knew it would take 40 years.
Yeah, you've been working on these centers for quite some time, I thought, right?
I've had working centers since 1977, but it was when they said, it wasn't when I said. And I've seen the electronics improve.
Yes.
So yeah. I'm in my 11th edition of the Clint E., the bed. In every house that we own two houses, I have a program. I can go and go anywhere I want to go. I can go upstairs and go in our room and I can set it up. I can set the frequencies. I can get on the bed and I can go anywhere I want to go. I can travel. I can come to your house and go through your laundry. But
that's kind of scary.
Well, it's
just kidding.
But hey, there's nothing I can do about that.
Hey, I want to ask you something because I feel that it's a key question. Not once, but twice, you had major NDEs. What was the difference between the experience the first time and the second time?
The first time was the most overwhelming because I got a chance to see what was the future. And I went to this crystal city, and it was so unbelievable. These beings of light that I encountered in this place that looked like it was built of light.
Yes,
and there were many of them. So we don't all come from the same place. I thought that this was where I was supposed to come. And when I met these beings, I had never seen what you would call the future. I never knew it was the future until 4 years later when Raymond, Dr. Moody, called me and said the first prophecy had come true. And it was about the election of a president, or it was about Chernobyl, or it was something I don't remember. And then all of a sudden, Raymond started telling everybody about the prophecies, which I just call boxes of knowledge. So I call that section of my life Nostradamus.
It's cute.
Well, because I don't, you know, this is part of a near-death experience. And I didn't know, I hadn't, think of this, Alexandra. I was 25 years old.
Well, you're just very young.
I was a hard ass, tough guy. I'm a big, powerful, tough guy. Sports, Marine Corps, and contracts for various agencies.
Right.
Mindset had nothing to do with Adam and Eve and guilty of the original sin. At 14 years old, I couldn't believe that, no matter what anybody said. I thought I was going to the Royal Ambassador's Fundamentalist Baptist Weekend for Wayward Boys because I'd knocked out the biology teacher. When I got there, they tell me I was guilty of the original sin. And I said, well, what was that? Well, you know what the original sin was? The original sin was some naked woman in some garden talking to a snake. Adam and Eve. I listened to this, and the snake, I thought, how long is a woman going to stay around if she sees a snake? Then number two, if that snake starts talking, and then the snake wants her to get her boyfriend to eat an apple so he knew he was naked.
Well, it is an allegory.
Well, let's hope so, but you can't get a fundamentalist Baptist in South
Carolina. That's true.
You can't get them to believe that, so I blew all that off. And until that day being struck by lightning, I never had a religious concept. I don't have a religious concept now. I have a spiritual concept.
Very distinct difference. Do you feel that the lightning strike was because of the fact that you were not going down a specific designated path?
Well, I would have to say that yes, because the skill set that I have, I mean, I have a certain skill set. I mean, I'm an observer, okay? And I can pay attention to what's happening, and I have a understanding of it. But now I'm empathic. So that skill set based on the lightning has gone from something that was normally like this to out here. I pick up 10 times more about what I observe and what I listen and how I hear. The second near-death experience was the same structure, okay? I lifted out of my body. I watched them cut my heart out of my chest.
Wow.
What they were talking about. I heard the seven chimes. I'm back down the tunnel. The being of light, by the time I got back down the tunnel the second time, I had a pretty good, you know, I'm obsessive compulsive whether I'm dead or alive. And
why is that? Well, how are you OCD on the other side of the veil?
Because I have to know.
Well, me too.
We all see this being, right? Watch. So I'm setting it up. I'm watching, waiting for the being of light to appear, right? This being that every Buddha, Jesus, Muhammad, Allah, you know, Krishna, everybody's got a name for it, okay? So when the being came the second time, which I wasn't paying so much attention to the being the first 13 years before, but I'd thought about it for 13 years, and I wasn't paying much attention. This time, I locked on this being of light, you know, because it was the feeling of safety and comfort that this being had given me the first time. When I was struck by lightning, I was paralyzed. After the near-death experience, I was completely paralyzed for 6 days, partially paralyzed for 7 months. It took me 2 years to learn to walk and feed myself. So I had plenty of time to think about it, and I still live in enormous pain, you know, because of the damage done to the lightning going down my spine. Okay, so I had a lot of time to think about it. So when I saw this being of light the second time, well, let me tell you, I can tell everybody who that being of light is. That being of light is you. You have never left heaven. Never. It's you. And your guardian angel is you. And, you know, people say, well, Daniel, that's hard to believe. Look, I can touch myself. I said, well, let me ask you a question, because I went on this quest. We are basically made up of, your body is made up of atoms, molecules, and cells, undeniable. If you take all the empty space out of an atom, it's 94.6% empty space. If you take all the empty space out of a molecule, it's 98.2% empty space. If you take all the empty space out of a cell, it's 99%. So if you take, let's say there's 320 million Americans living in the United States. If you took all the empty space out of every atom, every molecule, and every cell of every one of those 320 million people, we would all fit in a regular size matchbox. That's science. Mm-hmm. Okay, so what does that tell you? That tells you we are mostly conscious here. We are conscious. We're just a water bag. And people say, well, how does that work, Daniel? I said, wait a minute. When you're a diver, a deep sea diver, you put on a uniform, gloves, you put on lead boots, you put on a belt, you put on a big helmet, and you go down in the water, first because of pressure, second because of climate, you know, the amount of pressure, second because of climate, and third because of how much oxygen you need and the weight and the structure. When you come here, this is a water planet. The atmosphere is water, and it's electrical. We have an atmosphere, a stratosphere, and ionosphere, positive, neutral, and negative. Okay? So in order to function in this environment, it's the same as a deep sea diver. If you're a deep sea diver, you have a uniform on so that you can function. If your spine didn't do this, you could not. Based on your barometric pressure and the atmospheric pressure of the atmosphere, you couldn't stand up straight and walk.
Yeah, our bodies are amazing.
Yeah, you couldn't do it.
I'm in awe of the body.
Well, it's the same as if you were a deep sea diver. You'd be amazed at how much you like that little outfit you had on. But are you the deep sea diver in the outfit, or are you the person inside?
Yeah.
What divinity teaches and near death teaches you is you are the person inside this, and this is the piece of equipment that's necessary in order for you to function as a co-creator in a way that you can realize that you did it. We create life. We plant a garden. We have sex. And it's explainable. It's not some voodoo witch doctor. Now we know everything of how the sperm hits the egg, how the seed germinates. We know all that stuff now. But who created it? We did. Mm-hmm. No one's ever left heaven. Get over it. You have projected a part of your identity into this so that you could experience the actual event of appearing to be separate from something, but you're not. And to be an individual co-creator. You know, I get up for two reasons. That a veteran won't die alone because I woke up this morning. And this morning before I talk to you, I'm getting 24-hour nurses for a guy who might have 4 days. I call the VA, I call the hospice unit, I call the nurses, because most people don't understand the bureaucracy. I've been a hospice volunteer in the VA for 31 years, and I'm an old combat Marine, and I can terrify them just like I can terrify anybody else, because I know implementation, regulations, specifications, and enforcement. And if they start messing with me, I say, okay, tell me your job description. Because I can.
Where's your DD-214, right?
Yeah, tell me your job description, because I can look up exactly what your job description is and how long you've been at work. And if you've been there over 3 years, you did not adapt to it, then I can report you to what's called the patient advocate for that particular veteran.
That's fantastic, and they need that kind of support. I was going to ask you too, I mean, it's very obvious and apparent what you're providing them through the last days of in this reality. What difference do you see with what you're providing them on this side, on the other side? You know, whether they had your service and support with or without that.
Watch. The Twilight Brigade. I'm on both sides of the veil.
I know you are.
I got my boys on that side and my boys and girls on that side reaching out and helping the ones I'm with now. They reach out and bring them across the veil.
Fantastic.
There is a place, Alexandra, I call it the fertile void or the blue-gray place. And it's like purgatory. No one has to give up their free will till they go down the tunnel. And then they reconnect. They don't give up their free will, but they reconnect to the entire force. But there are people who are junkies and addicts and abused, and they're trapped in third near-death experience. I spent 41 hours in recovery, and I was fixated with this place. The Bardo, the purgatory, everybody's got a little name for it. And when you hear about people who went to hell based on their near-death experience, they just went to this particular level of consciousness. So I realized that after the third near-death experience, I created the Twilight Brigade because I could teach a way that the person who was taking the training could lose their fear of death because they're doing it to help someone else. So they're not dealing with it face up themselves. They're doing it to be of service. and that if you use the techniques, the holographic techniques that I've woven into it, then you're touching all levels of that being, all of in transition. So when that light surrounds them and they start down that tunnel or crossing the bridge or going over the meadow, there's all kind of different things that people see. It's not always just a tunnel. Then one of those beings that are trapped in that area will see that light and let go and follow that person down the tunnel back into the light. Veterans feel betrayed.
Yeah, they do.
Most undeserved. When you realize that 330,000 veterans have died waiting to get their appointment or waiting to have their classification reviewed, they die. And if you realize there is a system that the bureaucracy uses so that they can manage the budget given to protect these veterans, that they have a standard system. We call it the pink unicorn. I mean, that's we who understand the techniques, because I've heard it all. You can't tell me one of those stories that I won't come right back at you and telling you you're a liar.
Yeah.
Okay, so it's so prevalent, we have a name for it. Okay, so in the course of that, this is a part of us realizing we're at the shifting point. We're at world war, world peace.
Yes.
We're watching this next year, what's going to happen. When you realize the destruction of Gaza, and you realize what's happening in the West Bank, and you realize what Israel and what Israel is doing under the threat of its very existence, this is where people need to focus. And when you look at what we're doing to ourselves and then the destruction of the Middle East, because it's smart to break it down into tribal regions. You know, most people don't understand the Middle East came about in the Balfour Agreement after World War I. A bunch of British sat down and drew some maps. People think Jordan is as old as history. Jordan didn't come into existence to 1948. Okay.
Well, I mean, even you having the ability to prophesize, right? And I know you have a lot of prophecies about 2016 to 2018. You do stress that in your other interviews. Don't you feel that there is also the element that if we, consciousness-wise, I think you were talking about 3%? Was it 3%? 3%. Can't we change that reality?
Nothing's carved in stone.
Exactly.
This is something that those beings kept going over and over. As you're seeing this, nothing is carved in stone. Why I talk about it, I don't talk about it as a defeatist.
I know you don't. That's why I chose to interview you, by the way.
I'm not a defeatist. I believe in us. We are great, powerful, and mighty spiritual beings with dignity, direction, and purpose, and we just got to get out of our own way.
Exactly.
We have to find a meditative state, a place where you stop and you do it every day. You do it every day. And when you do it, you show the universe. I can feel the divine flow, Alexandra. I can feel it. And I can stop and I can feel that divine flow. And I know everything is based on gratitude, that you count your blessings before you face anger or anything else. Okay, I'm really mad. What am I have to be thankful for? The universe surrounds you with an energy that calms you. It's nothing you have to do. It's the natural systems at play. So, you know, you can think all night that the sun's going to come up, not going to come up. And then you can think that the earth is not spinning at 1,000 miles an hour. But guess what? The earth is spinning at 1,000 miles an hour. The sun's going to come up. The sun's going to come up.
Another day will face. You'll face. Yes.
Life. Every day is a different life.
Yes.
You live in the world that I live in. And breath becomes precious because I've been without it.
Yes. You have a total appreciation for it.
Breath becomes precious. And the breath that you breathe in and then you stop and the breath you breathe out are two completely different worlds. I live constantly knowing, and I study what you breathe in. Air is basically nitrogen, okay? It's 80% nitrogen. And then it's oxygen, and then two or three other little things, and some dust particles, and some chemtrails.
I knew you were going to say that.
You know, hey.
Barium.
Yeah, and aluminum, chloride.
Aluminum.
But, you know, this stuff is happening. Bill Gates went on and did an interview saying it, okay, because it's weather modification. So I looked up weather modification. 1948 to 1964, if you read the patents on weather modification, from 1947 to 1964, it was an epic period of weather modification patents. Anyone can look them up. And then came HARP, this HARP array, which charges the ionosphere, which controls the stratosphere and the atmosphere. So much of what we now are calling climate change has, if you look at this from a very sane point of view, many of the events we're now seeing occur are climate patents being applied. These patents are being applied because then I started looking at the companies. This is obsessive compulsive. I started looking at the companies who had bought or licensed the modification, weather modification patents. You know, who are these companies that have licensed it? You can look them up. So I see the 13 major companies that are in licenses and modifying and using weather modification. So all I ever ask is this: if we're going to do climate change and we're going to blame it on us because we all fart too much, you know, they were going to find people raising cattle as a flatulation. Okay. So finally they have something that you can be blamed for. It's you causing the problem. So once you create a worldwide global perspective of something that you're doing and it's your fault, then you subject yourself to so many other things. So all I want to know is every one of these companies and these governments that are talking about it to go in under oath, and have they ever used any of these since they've licensed or bought the patent for weather modification? Have they ever used it? And if so, how? Under oath. That should be a Senate or a congressional hearing. Absolutely. And let's get it out where we can look at it. I believe that
it's coming. It's coming.
I believe we will win. I believe that what's happening now in our electoral positioning is the thing I've been waiting for, the breakup of the control system. I think we should have multi-parties, you know, not these two parties, and this is what's going to happen.
I think so, too. Now, do you feel that there has to be a crumble? Do you feel that there has to be an avalanche of the empire falling in order to start anew?
Yeah.
You definitely feel that, right?
Absolutely. It's happening now. We're living in it. We have the highest trade deficit we've ever had in our lives. The highest.
But is it necessary for all the people on the planet to go through a state of devastation, no running water, no food, no whatever? Do you feel that that's part of it, or do you feel that we can avoid that part of it?
Well, I think that if we're not really careful, if we're not really, really, really careful, that will happen. Well, I'm out here. You know, I'm ready. I've been here 40 years. By the 78 or 79, I had everything in place. I'm safe. I know where to take my little bunch. Okay. I didn't listen to what people say. I don't care. Am I a prepper? Yes. Okay. You know, am I a Mormon? No. But am I a prepper? Yeah.
I've
been ready for 40 years, okay? So the point, you gotta have, listen, what are they gonna do, kill me?
You've already been there, done that.
Tell me what somebody can do to me. And what can you do to frighten me or intimidate me?
Oh, no. I don't think anybody questions that, Daniel. I don't think so. Hey, getting back to the 13 beings. So are the 12 beings basically a reflection of you?
I would say that they represented, you know, we have 12 disciples, we have 12 gate, 12 pearls, 12, 12, 12, all the way through, I have 44, 144, 12 is an ethereal number. So I think each of these were a symbolic representation of the great masters, Sunakumaras, the Kumaras, Christ was a Kumara. There are seven Kumaras, and Christ was one of the Kumaras. Sunat, they're all Kumaras. These beings that are a part of some hierarchical structure. You know, the universe is layered, and it's in dimensions.
That's what I was going to ask you. So how many dimensions do you think are in the universe?
Well, I can only say, based on looking at theoretical quantum mechanics, I look at a Planck came up with the first one, the German, and then an Englishman named Deutsch, using the string theory and a part of string theory called the chaos theory. He says that in the multi-universe theory, we occupy between 11 and 17 simultaneous dimensions. Well, when I first heard that, I realized finally why I was so tired when I wake up in the morning. Because if I'm having half as much fun in those other dimensions as I've been having in this one, I'm in a party animal like there's no tomorrow.
So do you feel that there are a lot of multiple timelines?
Yeah.
Still existing? I mean, for the mass consciousness.
Yeah. I see them. I live.
So how many? I mean, are there like a gazillion, or is it like what most people say that we're down to maybe four core timelines right now?
Okay. On my left side, if I move leftly, okay. If I go from my right brain, I can move three, possibly into another dimension, but I cannot consciously be aware of it.
Okay.
I move from my right side, which is dependent on which of my my brain I'm using. I can move into four dimensions. So there's seven. Okay, there's seven. It could be eight, but I cannot describe the three and a half one. But I can move depending on what I'm trying to learn or what I'm trying to diagnose or what I'm trying to create a model for so I can help advise people using grief, bereavement, trauma, the world that I live in, or looking at functional medicines, how to do alternative and functional positions as opposed to what you're being told. I mean, this is the world I live in.
Yeah. Okay?
So I focus my world there. I'm not all over the place. I'm knowledgeable because I'm obsessive compulsive, but I live in a certain framework, and this is what I do with my life. And mine is to lose the fear of death and empower this life as a co-creator. I mean, to imagine to have a physical appearing body, a consciousness, and the ability to create, co-creators. The world is everything and the tools I need to co-create. That makes me a god. That makes me a co-creator, and the opportunity to be godlike, that I can be kind and loving and helpful and thankful. And I take the most terrifying place there is, death and pain. And I live among pain and death every day. And I fight for people's rights every day. And this new book that Kat and I are writing is called 10 Things to Know Before You Go. And it's just usually me making fun of everything, you know, because people who read my books already know I'm going to be funny. You know, what are you going to do? Kill me. You open up the first page. It says, what is the number one cause of death in America and most other countries? You turn, big question mark. Turn to the second page. It says, no matter what you think, birth is the number one cause of death.
Wow.
Okay.
I wouldn't have thought that.
Watch it. See what everybody thinks. Then you turn to the next page and it says, remember, if you're breathing, you're leaving. And if you just took a breath, this book is for you.
Oh, perfect.
And I go through the 10 things that you need to focus on. And if you focus on these 10 things, you will see a new you. If you focus on these 10 things and how we've described them, and because Kat has a different slant. You know, hers is loving and caring and babying and hugging and the whole world and, you know, all that.
That's not like a former Marine, huh?
I go to automatic. I go, she says, you don't express any emotion. She said, you appear to be expressing emotion, but you're not. You're looking at what has to get done. And you're looking at what that person needs, whether it's the person in transition or the family member. And you're calm, which is something most people don't ever know me as being calm, but it's never about me. It's about them. And I completely devoid my identity so that I can absorb theirs and I can help them. People have to get through it and they have to understand birth was the cause of death.
Very interesting.
And if you didn't take care of yourself, whose fault is that? Mm-hmm. If there are DNA problems or atmospheric or conditions or whatever you did, you just contributed to the process. You did not create the process. You just contributed to it. Okay? But you need to look at that. In the end of life, Alessandro, this is the most important. People must have closure. And most of the time, if someone's sitting and listening without an opinion and they hear themselves talking, they can find closure. And that's my goal. But this paradigm based on, I always said that the battle for the souls of humankind would be fought in healthcare.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, yeah. That's affordable healthcare is collapsing. Drugs are going up outrageous. okay? Healthcare, there is no such thing as long-term healthcare. How affordable healthcare was created was the president took $500 billion out of Medicare, and that was for long-term care for nursing homes. There is no nursing homes. There isn't any more money for that, okay? And that's us.
Yeah, you're reminding me of an experience I had. I went with a friend of mine who wanted to do some healing on her grandmother. And I had not been to one of these so-called nursing homes in quite some time.
Rack 'em and stack 'em.
Yeah, and I walked in there, and we went in, and we all five did a healing on her, and then I took off. I wanted to go down the hallways and look, and all the doors were open, and I just burst into tears. I literally couldn't even handle it. I was so devastated by the way that each of these people, whether they were our brother, our sister, our mother, our father, our aunt, our uncle, our friend, you know, our companion, the lack of dignity, the fact that completely alone, totally ostracized from the rest of the world, no joy, no support, no respect. And it's something that's always been really near and dear to my heart. And that's another reason I wanted to interview today, because I feel that this is one of the hugest obstacles.
The most underserved society. Most underserved population. I have lived here for 38 years. I mean, I've been here for 38 years because if God couldn't come today and God sent me, in a life I will review, what difference did me and God make? Okay, for me, that means that that person that I'm sitting and holding their hand, and I'm an expert at this, I'm an expert holding their hand. When my life passes before me, I'm going to see them looking up in the eyes of the divine. And this is my sole purpose. This is
right
what
on.
It motivates me. I don't care about the fame and all that stuff. I don't care. You don't take any of that stuff with you. You know, I care about knowing that I've seen three of these panoramic life reviews. I've studied the panoramic life review more than any other part of the near death experience. I don't want to hear all that crap. I want to hear the life review. That's the only thing that's over there that you can bring back and apply back over here.
Interesting. Okay?
And this is where I live. I am practical, Alexandra. I live every day. I'm not I'm in the Swami business. That's what I call it because I've been dead, you know, and I listen to the craziest stuff in the world. But I hope it helps somebody, okay? But the clash of the paradigms, as we face what we've done to our veterans, I got a bumper sticker on the back of my car that says, "We must think war unthinkable." What the end product of war is doing to the devastation of our youth. Jimmy Carter said, we can never find peace by killing each other's children.
Absolutely.
Until that becomes the face forward fact, then we will never find this resolution. And then someone asked me, they said, "Dannon, let me ask you something since you've become such a pacifist baby." I said, "Well, it still doesn't mean I won't knock you out. I just have to see why I hit you in my panoramic life review. But if I was going to go to war today and I was running for president and somebody said, well, Daniel, what would be your reason? Would terrorism be your reason to go to war? No. Terrorism is political.
Absolutely.
What would be my reason? And that I would bring America to bear. And if it was 80 years old that we would fight. When you use rape of women and children, and you sell them for $10 or $12, and you take Christians, and you take women and children, and you rape them, and you force them to get married as acts of war. There shouldn't be a single American, a single Christian, a single woman, or a single man that did not stand up to that.
Well,
and when you drive people from their home, and you set and put up this terrorism, I'll take the terrorism. You blow up whatever you want. But if you don't stop raping children and killing children and raping your children in front of the parents and then executing them, I will fight. I cannot understand what this country's doing.
Yes.
We know this is happening. So if I was the president, I'd call the Joint Chiefs of Staff. I said, give me absolute clinical and unadulterated proof that this is happening. And then I will declare war. And I will declare war to stop that one thing. That one thing. That is the most horrendous, because I know those people get trapped in the blue-gray place.
Yes.
I know that that's where they're going. They're little kids.
I know, it's terrible. I am so glad to hear this, because I get a little bit of heat from some of the other people I interview whose sole goal is to expose the child sacrifice, in particular with the Vatican and the Catholic Church, but that's not just them. It's just all of this entire network across the world.
That's Satan worshiping, though, Alexandra. That's the Satan worshiping. And it's what David Wilcox talks about, and what David Icke talks about.
Right.
Mine is this. We know it, but we don't want to lose Jesus. Okay? We don't want to lose religion, because it's become such a power structure. If you look at the Vatican Bank, if you take a look at these things, you realize that even the United States is under the British and the Vatican. You have admiralty law, and then you have two forms. You have commercial law and admiralty law. Anytime you see your name in all capital letters, that means you're a corporation.
Yep.
Where is your birth certificate housed? You think, yes, it's a simple question. Where is my birth certificate? Is it at the, where would you keep a person's birth certificate? Would you keep it at the where you count names?
Administrative office or something like that.
At the Department of Commerce.
Right.
You are a piece of property.
Absolutely. You are a bond, and you were worth millions.
$3 billion.
$3 billion, right.
As a monetized instrument on the federal market, on the national market, as a bond is worth $3 billion, and that's why we're $19 trillion in debt. Okay, when you look at that, what's behind that is Satan worshiping. It's not so much Satan as it is to access levels of consciousness. I see those levels. I can feel that.
Oh, my God.
I can feel them.
How can you handle that? I mean, if you crawl into that part of the psyche of the mass consciousness, how do you handle it? You know, just because you have the ability, right, to see what's really going on.
Absolutely. Ugh. I can go into it, because it's not going to affect me. I do not seek fame or wealth. I mean, I'm pretty good. But what you do is you buy people with money. You buy them, and you create these atmospheres, because money is power in Western consciousness. Mm-hmm. The fact that my kids are okay, and that Catherine's not mad at me about okay. Other than that, people can kiss my ass. I don't care, you know. And when the bell rings, it's just my time, and I don't live there. I don't live in that, and I see it. I've had so many people come at me. Because I have this personality, I have some people come at me and try to pull me in, and I deal with death, and I built the Twilight Brigade, and I am really knowledgeable how the healthcare system operates. And I have had them come at me and offer me, when hospices were for nonprofit, I've had people come at me to get me to come in and be on their boards, to pay me to go and be a part of that hospice program. It because if you look at Medicaid and Medicare, if you own nursing homes and you don't have a hospice program, then you won't get paid. So if you don't have a hospice program, and they didn't want a nonprofit, they wanted to be able to turn into a corporation, and then they wanted to be able to buy them, and they wanted to use me to do it. Well, I would be a multimillionaire more times than you can imagine if I had bought into it.
Well, and they want to keep that wheel going. I mean, I have several friends that are in hospice care. They're both nurses. And the stories that they've told me, not only do they turn my stomach, but the bottom line is the individual is not sent into the home to try to help them get well. The individual must stay within the protocol to make sure that they die. And they have only a certain period of time in which to die, or that hospice center does not receive the funding that they're supposed to receive. It's just disgusting.
6 months. Sell dope. Oh, no. So could you tell those two friends of yours that are hospice nurses that I, Daniel Brinkley, said I love them with all my heart, and for what they are courageous enough to keep at it.
Very courageous.
Then you tell them, if I ever meet them or see them someplace, they're going to get the biggest, sloppiest kiss that two women could ever possibly get, and they're going to get a hug that's going to probably squeeze the life out of them.
I will do that. And also, they actually help people transition to the other side as they're doing it. It's one of the main reasons they were called to do it, because we need more and more of those. It's just like what you said, that blue gray area, they get stuck there, all those children's souls. It's a horrible thing.
And we are allowing it to happen. We're allowing the highest power, the Pope, and he's trying to do a decent job, I think, but we're allowing this to go on. We're allowing this to happen, and for what reason? So Jesus won't get mad at us, and we're allowing what we call ISIL or Dasha. Those people are funded by the United States. We created ISIS. We did it. 85% of all the equipment that they have came from us. It's American made. Okay, well, let me ask you a question. How do they resupply? Yeah, I'm a combat Marine.
They do it through BP and ExxonMobil through the funding of the oil companies, which are behind the whole thing.
Well, the oil companies, look what the Russians did. The Russians blew up 1,000 tankers. 1,000 tankers. Why gas was $1.87 was they were stealing oil from Iraq and Syria, selling, refining it in Turkey, and selling it worldwide. Who was buying it? So how do they still supply? Those bullets and those mortars have to be made somewhere. They're made in America. So how do they keep resupplying their ammunition? Okay.
So, Daniel, you mean there's still things being made in the United States of America?
Or assembled.
That's like a concept.
Well, if you look at a .223 round for an M4, what is a standard weapon in the United States, our bullets are made in China because they need tungsten. So all the bullets that the Americans use for war are manufactured in China. Okay, what kind of scam is that?
It's totally a scam.
So here's our point. We are at the juncture of where the clash of the paradigms is on us.
I agree.
And if we don't stop, take a deep breath, open up our hearts and receive, know that in the calmness there is a divine flow, that if you start in gratitude, what are you thankful for? And you start in gratitude, you got a chance. And if you don't, you will be a part of a system that turns you into a slave, and from that you will turn into eugenics. They will get rid of 5 or 6 billion of us because that is not a manageable supply system based on the concept that is being used that comes from the old, like David Icke says, the old reptilian concept. We need X amount of miners, X amount of food, X amount of products, so that we can live that life of luxury and communication with those elemental forces like the Ouija board, but those forces that I can sense those levels of consciousness. They're about empowerment and about ego and about narcissism. The way America has raised its children since the establishment of the banking system that we now use, the Brentwood, Dunwoody, system, is we all hope our children will grow up to be narcissistic sociopaths. And if you look at every successfully wealthy person, look at Donald Trump. I can't say he's bad, I can't say he's good, but I can say he's a narcissistic sociopath. Okay? And then you look at Bernie. We have a narcissistic sociopath on one end, we have a communist on the other end, and we have Hillary. Okay? And this is where we have. This is what we have. So we are watching the shifting and the change in the demise of hundreds of years old, but the last 100 years since the Civil War.
Yeah.
When we created commerce and admiralty law and merged them, when we went from sails to steam, okay, from we went from a sailboat to a steamboat, which mandated insurance on delivery. That's admiralty law. Tort reform came out of is commerce, and canon law is completely left out. You don't even see the 13th or the 14th Amendment. When you look at reading the amendments to the Constitution, you don't even see the 14th Amendment.
Well, because it's not legal, you know?
Yeah, so I go there too.
Well, man, Daniel,
I've been so boring. You want to hurry up and get off?
No, we're only slotted for an hour, and I know you're on a time crunch.
Yeah.
No, I would love to call you back on to go over your prophecies.
Well, just get a hold of Kat, Alexander. You know, I'm out here, and I'm going to fight to the last breath I draw. That's what I'm going to do.
And nobody's
going to frighten me.
No, and we just, I really want to thank you, because that is one huge sector of the population, those that are passing and dying, those that are interned and also, very sickly, that we have completely turned our back on. I remember meeting a healer, and you could have heard a pin drop, and he was doing a workshop, and he was from Taiwan, and he said the most memorable moment of his life was when he got off of the plane from Taiwan. He landed in, I believe it was New York City or something, and he said when he stepped off the plane and he started walking around through the community, he said he didn't even know what to do, because he looked at all of the people, maybe in their 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, and he said he couldn't believe how many people were walking around with a walker, and how many people were hunched over like this, and how many people were just completely riddled with pain in their face. And he said, I literally fell to my knees and cried out and said, God, why have you brought me here? And I mean, the whole audience started crying. And it was such an impacting moment for all of us to recognize, you know, it's great for all of these causes, but this cause is very important as well, because we all have to face it sooner or later that we will be checking out one day.
What's the number one cause of death in America and most other countries?
Birth. I got it right.
And once you realize that, Alexandra, once you realize it, then it's the steps that we take and how we look at ourselves and think about ourselves. And I want everybody to please come. I've been doing this show with Kenny since he started. I like it. I don't charge Kenny as much as I charge for most programs that I do, because I love to see the people.
Yeah.
I like to get around them and hug them and walk around with them and talk to them and get a chance to that place where I normally go on the stage and I have to leave, or it's signing a book or where's Kenny? I can just walk around, you know, I can hug everybody. I can spend time with them, and I think that my presentation only costs what it is to get into the show.
Yeah, it's really reasonable, everybody. And what he's referring to is the New Living Expo. It's in San Mateo, California, at the San Mateo County Event Center. And Daniel will be doing his presentation on the Clash of the Paradigms on May 1st, which is Sunday. And I know you have a couple other ones. Did you want to plug those?
Well, those are panels. If you're going to come, look, I have a Friday night introduction, because I don't mind doing it. You know, I don't mind doing anything that helps promote people coming and being able to gather in a place where they can listen to a presentation and walk out in the hall and they can buy it. They can have it to take home with them. It's very rare that you get in a place that has the vendors that have the same stuff that you need to help you experiment, fulfill, or try, or get from somebody else something that the people are there. And I always just enjoy it. Kat and I have a really good time. And I've been out here so long, most of the people out on the circuit are children to me. They may be a little older or mostly younger than me. But I've liked to watch them grow and to support them.
You've really put your time in more ways than one. And you've definitely blazed the trail for this. And the Twilight Brigade is one of the greatest gifts you could ever give humanity, seriously.
Well, that's what they sent me to do.
That's awesome.
I'm like a Marine. You give me orders. It's objective, accomplishment, 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 accomplishment. I think that's why they gave it to me, Alexander, because nothing will stop me. Nothing.
Spoken like a true Marine.
Hoorah, get some.
So I know many of them. So
you get, when you see them, you tell them I love them too.
Absolutely.
And I appreciate you having me.
I have enjoyed
this from the bottom of my heart. I hope I can come back, and anything that I can do that helps move your program forward and that to help interview the people who can make a difference and to inspire them. And I hope that together today we have inspired someone to pay attention to their breath.
Right on, right on. And as I say all the time, you're tapping right into that 1940 to 1967 audience, because that's primarily who's on right now, who's listening.
They're all my babies.
Well, I would not say they're my babies. Well,
I'm going to say they're mine. You know, what are they going to do? Get over it. All right.
Well, don't forget, everyone, his website is Danyon and Catherine, danion.com, Danion, D-A-N-N-I-O-N, and Katherine, K-A-T-H-R-Y-N.com. Check him out. He's amazing. He also does readings. He's just, you know, he has kind of the reputation that precedes him.
Oh, that's good. I love him. Thank you from the bottom of my heart. I love you, and I'll look forward to the next encounter on this really wonderful type, innovative technology.
Sounds good. Now you know how to use Zoom.
Yeah.
See, you learned something today.
And I am sincerely and honorably thankful to you.
And you as well.
All right, be Thank blessed.
You. Thank you, everyone, for listening. And if you haven't already checked out galacticconnection.com and our daily blog, as well as our implant removal processes, and also check out our newest and greatest and latest, which is the Guardian Protection Initiation Process. It's awesome. Really helps out with artificial intelligence. Talk to you guys later. Lots of love. Take care.